So after you've been married for a little while, you start to have conversations, but you forget to give the context of the conversation. Now, my wife and I have been married 18 years, and we do this all the time. She started the conversation the other day. When we were at Pullen Park for Lincoln's birthday, and you went to get 17 tickets for the train ride for five-year-olds, that's insane. We had 17 five-year-olds. I turned around, and I looked at the balloons, and there was mud all over the balloons. And I thought to myself, how did mud get all over the balloons? And a park ranger was walking up, and so my wife asked the park ranger, how did mud get all over the balloons? And the park ranger said, well, they're stinging insects, and you should be careful. And as my wife looked up, there's stinging insects everywhere, chasing children and attacking her. And then one of our friends lowered an airplane, and Jack Bauer jumps out and starts shooting. And I'm like, wait a minute, Jack Bauer, were you dreaming? She goes, yeah, I was dreaming. It's like, don't you think that might be an important part of the conversation, that this is not real, but it's pretend? Now, here's what had happened. Parts of the week seeped into her dream and just became tangible in her dream. I had killed some hornets on the porch, and she kind of internalized that. And we did have a birthday party for Lincoln at Pullen Park. And clearly, I'm the Jack Bauer figure that she had dreamed about. And so it just kind of seeped in. And we're going to see that today in the passage in Song of Solomon 2 and 3. They've had a day of conversation where his wife has said, you've done some really amazing large things. You've got the essential parts of marriage down, but there's some smaller things that are starting to eat it away, and we better take care of those things. And in chapter 3, it starts with a dream. She's dreaming back about the day, and she wakes up, and she feels like she's been abandoned by Solomon, and she runs to find him so she doesn't lose the one that she loves. Now, the rating is a little bit G today, and yet I'm going to try to pick some fights. I'm going to try to pick fight with men, and I'm going to pick a fight with women, which terrifies me, and I'm going to pick a fight with parents, which is probably the least intelligent thing that you can do. And so let's go to God's Word and start in chapter 3. We'll look at verses 1 through 4. They say this. On my bed by night, I sought him whom my soul loves. I sought him, but found him not. I will rise now and go about the city in the streets and in the squares. I will seek him whom my soul loves. I sought him, but found him not. The watchmen found me as they went about in the city. Have you seen him whom my soul loves? Scarcely had I passed when I found him whom my soul loves. I held him and would not let him go until I brought him into my mother's house, into the chamber of her who conceived me. As long as I can remember, I've had a very active sleep life, and that's not a very good thing. I sleep talk, I sleep walk, I sleep attack. You name it, almost, I sleep do. When I was a little kid, it started. There was one story where I walked into my parents' room in the middle of the night. I put all of my mom's clothes on. I sat in their rocker and started rocking. That's like a horror story. Like Chucky is in your bedroom. You wake up, somebody has your clothes on, and they're staring at you asleep. My parents were terrified. I took all the clothes off, walked back to my bed asleep. Don't remember any of the story at all. Another true story. My folks had friends from out of town spending the night in my brother's room. And for some reason, while I was asleep, I opened their door, ran in, and started yelling, stick 'em up, stick 'em up, stick 'em up. They jump up, yell bloody murder, run out into the hall. My whole family's awake, and I casually walk to bed and go back to sleep. Don't remember it. Now, it's not just when I was a little kid that this is a problem, but it's happened recently. I'll jump out of the bed in the middle of the night, grab all of the covers, yank them off onto the floor, start smashing in the bed, yelling, spider, 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 and then get back in bed. I'll say, Kimberly, the next morning, how'd you sleep? She goes, I was terrified. You tried to kill me like I was a spider, right? And then I'll have dreams about my children that are so vivid that I'm sure they actually just transpired. And I'll jump up out of bed, this time awake, run into their room, open the door, make sure that they're safe, wake them up, kind of turn them around, look at their whole body, put them back in bed, and then go back to sleep. Because sometimes dreams are so vivid, they motivate you to do things. And that's what's happening in this passage. Solomon's wife has had a dream that's so vivid that it motivated her to do something. It says, right there in the passage, on my bed by night. She was sleeping and she woke up, and she dreamed that Solomon had totally abandoned her. And it had seeped in from the night before, from the day before, as they had conversation about their relationship. They were trying to work out some issues because they feared if those issues weren't dealt with, it would lead down a path of coldness and then cohabitation and ultimately abandonment. And they didn't want to get into that place. Now, abandonment rarely to never just happens. It's something that begins to transpire over time, right? Nobody ever wakes up and thinks, I have a great friendship with this person. It's thriving. And I think I'll call them today and say, we're all done. I'm not going to be friends with you anymore. Nobody wakes up after 10 and 15 years of marriage beside somebody that you really love and adore and think to yourself, oh, we're just done. No, over time, you begin to make decisions. You begin to allow things to seep into your relationship that slowly begin to pull you apart. You see, just like you came together, you're either making the decision to get closer together or slowly be pulled apart. You begin to pursue oneness. You're seeking understanding, and you're seeking laughter, and you're seeking mutuality, and you're seeking adventure and intimacy, time shared. And when you're doing that, you're choosing to deepen your oneness. Or, whether it's intentional or not, you're finding comfort in another person. You're starting life patterns that separate you with your job, with your hobbies, with your desires. You're not forgiving very quickly, and so coldness seeps in. And it's led you to a place of deception and ultimately isolation. Now, none of you wanted mediocrity in your marriage, in your relationships. You might have settled for that. But I promise you, on wedding day, when you saw your spouse down the aisle for the very first time, you didn't think to yourself, I hope in 15 years this has really gone very poorly, right? That was never a consideration. You never thought, I hope I waste the next 2 decades of my life and wake up and just go our separate way. Now, you want intimacy, and you want depth, and you want to thrive. But as you choose smaller steps that seem like they're not going to do any damage, it's slowly taking you to places that you're being ripped apart. Now, as I did research this week, and it's actually helpful research, I have 6 warning signs of how your relationship might become more of a place of abandonment. And I want to read them to you more than anything to wake you up and allow you this week to kind of hold your relationship out, hold your marriage out, and look at it in a very clear way and see, is that you? And so here are the 6 points that are warning signs of maybe your relationship is off track. Number 1, a feeling that your mate isn't hearing you and doesn't want to understand what you're trying to communicate. Number 2, one or both of you have an apathetic attitude, an attitude that says, why try? Or I don't want to work on this marriage. Number 3, you seem unable to please your mate or meet your mate's expectations. You're leading separate lives. Number 4, your mate is withdrawing from you. Number 5, your mate refuses to accept responsibility for the marriage. That's your problem and not mine. And then finally, number 6, one or both of you believe that avoiding conflict is better than dealing with the pain of reality. Now, if it leads to a place where you find yourself in abandonment is one of the most tragic experiences that a human being can endure. It includes relational abandonment, spiritual abandonment, intimate abandonment, and ultimately physical abandonment. The coldness and the shock that begins to seep down into you is really almost impossible to recover from. I sat in my office one day with a man and his wife, and the man had gotten into some weird video stuff and had broken some of his covenant with his wife, abandoned that part. And the wife looked at him and immediately said, I will never be intimate with you again. And the coldness just froze the room out, and that couple didn't make it. Now, I'm not using that to try to scare you, but I am using it to show you that it's a real issue. It makes you feel isolated. It makes you feel depressed. It makes you feel like there's no hope at all. And it's pandemic in our churches and across the United States. The feeling is really unbelievable. And so I want to address 3 different groups of people here today. And if you don't fit in one of these 3 groups of people, it might be you tomorrow. One phone call, one discovery, one realization, and then all of a sudden you're in this group. And so this might not only be training for you, but unfortunately it might be preparation. I want to talk to men and women who have experienced a divorce, and I want to talk to people who grew up in a broken home, and then finally in this first section I want to talk to people that are in marriage that are considering divorce. Now, if you don't hear anything else today, this precursor is by far the most important thing. You have an advocate who understands the pain and difficulties of abandonment better than even you do. Jesus experienced more abandonment than any human being ever to live. Multiple times in his ministry, his family thought he had actually gone insane and went to scenarios to remove him from that situation. They abandoned him spiritually, and they really had abandoned him as a son and as a member of the family. Not only was his family guilty of that, but his best friends were. When Jesus was falsely arrested and accused of things that he had not done, when he was tried and tortured and crucified, his friends were asked, "Don't you know this guy?" And his closest friend said, "I don't know him. I never knew him. I don't even know what you're talking about." And then on the cross, Jesus experiences the greatest form of abandonment. For all of time, God the Father and God the Son and God the Spirit had been in perfect relationship with one another. And it says in the New Testament that Jesus became our sin. He became our hatred. He became our lust. He became our gossip. But most plainly, he became your rebellious heart. And because God the Father is holy and he's righteous and he is over all things and he can't participate in sin and he has no part in sin, he looked at the Son and turned away. And Jesus' dying words are, my God, why have you forsaken me?" Jesus knows more abandonment than we ever will. The thing that will not happen to you happened to Jesus. God the Father promises you here today, "I will not leave you and I will not forsake you and nothing can remove you out of my hand." But God the Father turned away from the Son because the Son became my sin. What love is that? What amazing love is that? That the Father adores you so much that he would abandon his own Son so that his Son could pay the penalty so that you would never be forsaken or left or abandoned ever. This is the love of a great God. The claims of Christianity are so outrageous. If you're not a follower of Christ and you're going to reject Christianity, do it because it's too great and it's too outrageous, right? The claim is this: Jesus knows the pain of your abandonment. He knows it specifically. He became one of us so he could look at us and say, "I know that." And he knows the way to the cross. He's the only one who knows the way to the cross. And the cross is the place where your abandonment meets the acceptance of Christ. And the acceptance of Jesus is always greater than the abandonment that anybody else can do towards you. And the outrageous claim of Christianity is this: Jesus can and desires to resurrect you. He can resurrect anything, and he can resurrect everything. And no matter where you've been or how badly you've been abandoned, he can resurrect you. These are the claims of Christianity. We invite you, surrender to him, give your life over to him, and find the acceptance in him. How beautiful that is. And so with that as the precursor, I get to look at you as men and women who've experienced divorce, and I can tell you, it's not what God intended for you, but he's not surprised by it. He has seen all of the broken things that have been done to you. All of the harsh words, all of the abuse, all of the broken promises. He knows it all. And he knows all the brokenness that you've done, all the lies that you've told, all the words that you spoke back, all the ways that you broke the covenant as well. And he has empathy on you. He looks at you and he says, "I know, my sweet daughter. I know. I know how you've been torn apart. My heart weeps for you. I know, son. I know how you feel totally alone and it's not right. And I'm so sorry that these things have happened to you." See, God's not plotting your doom. God doesn't hate you. He's not angry with you. Away with those lies. He's plotting your resurrection. That's what he's doing right now. He's plotting your renewal. That's the promises of Jesus. And so our hope, if we've been in a place where we've been divorced and we felt that abandonment, is that Jesus is here right now. And as you enter into a place like this, you enter into a place where there is an all-powerful and all-knowing and all-present God, and he has the desire and the capacity to change you. And if you would just let him, he will heal you. Now, the hard part of divorce is this: healing might not come the way that you think it will or hope it will. Healing might not be a restoration of the marriage that you were once in, and that's what you want most. And so that's difficult. And healing might not be that he allows you to be married again and brings another person into your life. But in this case, healing is God dealing with your heart. He wants to restore your heart. And the only place that you'll really ever find healing for your heart after you've been abandoned is to rest in the presence of the only one who is absolutely whole. And when you finally rest in the presence of the whole one and you realize he'll never forsake you and never abandon you, your broken, chaotic heart starts to find its place again, and it's healed up and it's made whole again. This is your only hope for the healing of the heart. Now, if you're currently in the process of divorce or it's recent, these words seem too shallow. And I know that. It seems too shallow to say, "Learn to rest in the presence of the one who is whole." There's no way that I can convince your heart with my foolish words. But Jesus has this ability to siege your heart and to grab tight of it. And after the siege is over, to seize it and bring it close to him, to captivate that heart, and to bring understanding immediately that that once scattered heart has now been made calm and whole again. And so we pray that you would hear and listen and put yourself in a place where Jesus can speak so that can happen to you. And in the meantime, you're surrounded with men and women who have been abandoned and who have been crushed by divorce and are on the other side of that. Like being on the other side of death, they can look back and say, I know that's broken and I know that's hard, but Jesus really is able to do that. And that gives you hope and that gives you patience and that gives you understanding that you can have that happen as well. We let him. Now, if you've been divorced, I don't know how other churches have treated you. Sometimes churches treat you like you have a scarlet letter on you. They look down at you and they wag their finger at you and they feel pretty elitist because they haven't done what you have done. But I can promise you in this church, that will not happen. I can't control all of the people that come here, but I can promise you that from the leadership, you will not be treated as less than. You will not be treated as some scarlet lettered figure. You are welcome in this place. And if you find yourself here today and you are one of those finger waggers who likes to look at other people who have made mistakes and point at them, you're welcome to do that, but just not here. You can enjoy your judgmental life, but you need to do it somewhere else, because the precursor for entering into this place is a realization that there's a great one and you're not him, and that you need something to put your life back together. And we meet at the feet of Jesus, and we believe that he alone is able to do that. And so we come broken, and we come abandoned, and we come crushed, and we come ruined. And we meet the one who heals us, and he alone is worthy of our worship. And so you come if you're broken. You come if you're in need of him, because that's what this place is about. Now I want to talk to the men and women who are here that have grown up in a home that was broken. It might have been broken because of divorce, and it might have been broken because you have an overbearing parent that was just oppressive and maybe even abusive. I realize that abandonment is not a dream of yours, but you lived that life. And probably parts of the series has been very difficult for you because week in and week out, we're talking about what it looks like to have a marriage that's thriving. And we're talking about developing an environment in our homes where our kids can see Jesus. And you think, I want that, but it's never been my reality. And I would like that, but it's probably never going to be available for me. Now, here's how Jesus heals this a lot. And it's going to take time, right? It's not a month and it's not a year. It's probably a decade. But God has dumped you into the midst of an eternal family. And the role of the eternal family is to create a space where you can see Jesus work and know that the gospel, that he renews all things, is available for you. It's ingenious how he's worked this thing out. He's dumped you in my life and he's dumped me in your life. And I tell you week in and week out that my life is sinking and I have massive problems and I named them by name specifically. So you're very aware that I'm not the hero and that there is a hero. And then I try to use my life to say, look, I mean, look, he's right here. And with placid words at his glory and his peace and his mercy and his steadfast love. And I try to point with actions and with everything that I am so that you might see Jesus and invite you. He's right here. And he promises that he's not going to forsake you or leave you. And he has the capacity to heal you if you would just let him do that. And then you're supposed to do that for me and for one another as we live in this eternal family that believes that Jesus is greater and the gospel is capable to bring healing to our lives, right? It's why Sundays are so important. You don't come here because you're supposed to. And you don't come here primarily to hear a sermon or to sing some songs. You come here so other men and women can see what Jesus has done in your life. It's an opportunity for your soul to yell out as you worship songs, I was once dead and now I'm alive. I was once broken and I've been renewed. And so you sit up front and you use your life and you use everything that Jesus has done to provoke your heart to sing out of the goodness of Jesus so that your eternal family, those men and women who need to see you do that, can look in and say, if that person can be healed, then I can too. That's why community is so important in groups and in your home and over coffee, that you can speak tangible things that this was ruined, but God has restored it. And this was what I was like, but not because of me, but because God is great. It's been changed. And we just have this messy life. And our primary message is this. We follow a God who specializes in worst case scenarios. And that's really good news because I'm the worst case scenario and so are you. And we use our lives as an eternal family to walk beside men and women who have experienced abandonment. And we tell them, God never will do that to you. These are the promises of Scripture. And so if you grew up in a home that was broken, welcome to a family that's broken, that's being healed by the one who is whole. And finally, I want to make sure I speak to men and women who are currently married that maybe flirt with the word divorce and throw that word around and use that as a threat. We use it as a threat for shock and awe, and we use that word for advantage. The moment you use that word, you have your mate on their heels, and then you have the power and you can control the conversation from there forward until they get angry enough and they use the word back. Now, doing this is not godly and it's not helpful, and you're crushing something that you stood in the presence of Jesus and that he wants to change that and heal that. And so I beg you, implore you, would you please eradicate the word divorce from your vocabulary and from your vernacular? Don't use it. It's off limits. Don't participate in it on any level at all. If Jesus can enter into the brokenness of this world, and he can change all brokenness into wholeness, and he has changed your broken heart into a whole heart, then he can absolutely come into your marriage, no matter how messed up that marriage is, and bring wholeness to it. And so we invite you to sit in the presence of a God who can do that. So abandonment doesn't have to be your story anymore. It doesn't have to be the end of your relationship, and that past abandonment doesn't have to dictate your future wholeness. Now, that's what she's worried about at first, and what had spawned that in her life was the conversation that she had had in the day before. Let's see parts of that in verses 8 through 14. The voice of my beloved, behold, he comes, leaping over the mountains and bounding over the hills. My beloved is like a gazelle or a young stag. Behold, there he stands behind our wall, gazing through the windows, looking through the lattice. My beloved speaks and says to me, arise, my love, my beautiful one, and come away. For behold, the winter is past, the rain is over and gone, the flowers appear on the earth, the time for singing has come, and the voice of the turtle dove is heard in our land. The fig tree ripens its fig, and the vines are in blossom, and they give forth fragrance. Arise, my love, my beautiful one, and come away. My dove, in the clefts of the rock and the crannies of the cliff, let me see your face and let me hear your voice, for your voice is sweet and your face is lovely. Okay, so if you read that carefully, it kind of seems like Solomon's a peeping Tom, doesn't it? Like the Bible's advocating spying and peeping. And if you didn't get that, you should read more closely, and that you don't think that's funny is a little disturbing to me, because maybe you're doing this and you shouldn't be. Okay, so Solomon is not a peeping Tom here. He's not looking in the window like trying to spy in the bedroom. He's in the outside of the outer wall, and he's looking in on the lattice. And what it's implying is Solomon has taken a step back, and he's not looking at just the day conversation, and he's not looking at just what's happened to his wife on that day, but he's trying to see the broader perspective of what's happening in his wife's life so he can be a good husband and love his wife. Do you remember what we said a few weeks ago? That Solomon's wife is in a period of winter. Her brothers were angry at her. She was forced to do endless manual labor. She doesn't like the way that she looks, and she doesn't like the life that she's had. And Solomon decides to use his strength and his power to engage her, to change her view about herself, and to ultimately change the course of her life. Now, when you hear that, that's a huge undertaking. You might think to yourself, well, that would be nice to have that much time to do that, but I just don't. I want to push back on that just a little bit. Solomon was a king of a growing nation. He had all the pressures of the president of the United States. He was commander-in-chief of his military, and every spring in the time of Solomon, they went off to war. That's an impossible task. He was the wisest sage in the planet at that time, and so men and women from all nations came to sit at his feet. His appointment schedule was booked for years, and he was trying to love God, writing psalms and using his giftedness to point to the grandeur of who God is. And so his life was immensely full. Yet in the midst of this, he takes the time to look in on his wife and to make sure that her life is going well. He's overseeing her life. Now here's the point where I pick a fight with women. And here's the fight. The feminism that is happening in our country that says men and women are equal is good and godly, and Jesus started it. He's the greatest figure ever to speak of the equality of men and women. The feminism that speaks against any abuse, any domestic violence, any violence at all towards women is good and godly, and Jesus has the most to say about that ever. The feminism that speaks about the right to vote and the right for fair wages, these are all good and godly things. But the feminism that says, I am woman, hear me roar, I need no one else, is just utter foolishness. Forget that independent life where you need no one else. I promise you, you'll be 40 and 50 years old, and you will be bitter, and you will be alone because you are not created to live life that way. Do I need somebody looking in on my life? Absolutely, I do. Do I need my wife looking in? Yes, absolutely. She has more capacity to move and change and sway than anyone else. Do I need men looking in on my life? Yes, absolutely, I do. This is a glorious thing. Solomon loves his wife enough that he would look in and take care of her. And when she's suffering, he's not going to just be indifferent and say, whatever. But he's going to engage her and try to bring change. And then the fight that I want to pick with men is this, that we are good at speaking lofty expectations and declaring what we're going to do and never following through. We give all of our energy to the things that we like, and we declare that our wife is of most importance, but our resources and our passion and our time doesn't say that that's the case. And so you can fight back on this one and you'll lose, not because I'm stronger, but in this case, I'm right. If your hours and days and dollars and years don't demonstrate that your wife is of utmost importance, she's not. You can tell me all that you want to, with eloquent words waxing and waning, that she's most important. And if it's not seen in your life with your actual resources, there's no chance that that's the case. No chance. And so Solomon sees his wife and he does something about it. He makes it his goal. He looks at her and he says, I want to see your face. He wants to see all the facial expressions so he knows exactly what's going on. And he says, I want to hear your voice. Not just the words that come out of your mouth, but what's going on in your heart. He says, I know you've been in a winter, but I've done things to bring change for you and to you. And so now the winter's gone. The rain is finished. There are flowers where there were no flowers. The spring is here. Let's enjoy life because God has done something amazing. And his wife then tells us what he's done. He's leapt the mountains and he's hurdled hills. The mountains and the hills are the large, really important things in marriage that have to be there and are essential in every marriage. I'm going to share four of them with you rather fast. And when I share these, this isn't a lofty picture of marriage. This is not a utopian picture of marriage. This is what we vow to each other as we stand in the presence of one another and make a covenant together. So this is our vows, right? So one essential thing that has to be in your marriage and really in all relationships is peace. And if you want to make peace tangible, then say this, ask your spouse this, you're first. Your first brings peace into your marriage. Here's how. Peace is not an absence of conflict. Peace is being grounded, being secure in the midst of conflict. And Jesus ultimately gives us that peace, and then he gives us a spouse and says, die to yourself so you can bring security and thriving and ultimately groundedness to that person. And so when you're constantly demonstrating to your spouse that they're first, you have a grounding that's significant. They can lose their job, and you can stand beside them and say, I know this is a really difficult thing, but you're first in my life. I'm here with you. We're grounded, and we're going to make it through this. Your kid can be really sick, long-term sick even, and that can be an overbearing thing in your life. But as you look at your spouse and demonstrate that you're first, it allows you to say, we're going to make it through this. There's going to be peace that transcends even this scenario. You're first in my life. So I want you to go home this week and talk to your spouse and just ask that question. Hey, do you feel like you're first in my life? And if they say no, you don't have to fear that. It's okay to be in a broken place. Just don't stay there. Jesus can help you out of that. You need in your marriage selfless love. And selfless love is not based on circumstance or temporal nature. It's not based on an emotive feeling. A selfless love is you have all of my heart. Another person doesn't have my heart. A job doesn't have my heart. Success doesn't have my heart. You have all of my heart. The heart is the center of your will. And so when you love someone with your heart, you're saying, I love you with all of the force of my will. You have my heart. I'm not going to keep records of wrongs. The force of my life is stronger than that. I'm not going to be a clanging cymbal or a banging gong. I'm going to rejoice in truth. I'm going to hope all things, bear all things, believe all things, and trust all things. You have my heart, and I'm going to love you selflessly. That's a beautiful thing. It's a foundational piece in your marriage. The third foundational piece is faithfulness. Faithfulness says this: you have all of the force of my life, all of the strength of my life, right? It's not enough to look at your spouse and say, well, I haven't lusted over another person. That's just baseline faithfulness. Real faithfulness is all of the force of who I am is invested in your life. I'm loyal to you. I'm going to provide for you. I'm going to look into your life. I'm going to walk with you when you're in a desert. I'm going to bring water when you're in the winter. I'm going to bring warmth. You have all of the force of my life, and I'm going to be faithful to you. Solomon was doing that really well, and his wife praises him. You've leapt the mountains. You've bounded over the hills, the really important things. And then finally, you need comfort in your relationship. And comfort can be best seen when your spouse realizes you're always for them. You're always for them. There's never a moment that they have to wonder, you're going to take your mom's side? You're going to take neighbor's side? You're just going to leave me stranded? No, you know with absolute certainty that sometimes they say hard things, but it's for you. Sometimes they say gracious things, and it's for you. And that changes you. Look, do you wonder why sometimes your wife will never talk to you about deep things and always goes to her mom? It's because she doesn't know that you're always for her. She doesn't have that comfort. Do you want to know why your husband never opens up at all to you? It's a comfort issue. He doesn't know that you're for him. This is really essential for us. So last week we talked at length that we need to develop this atmosphere, this environment that we can thrive. And certainly they're doing it here again. They've got the essential, really large, absolute key things down. Selfless love and faithfulness and peace and comfort. And when that's in your marriage, you can begin to thrive. It allows the really important things to move forward. And then Solomon's wife says, that's amazing, but look, we have some issues. There's some smaller things that have stacked up, and there's so many smaller things. They're starting to erode away the roots of our marriage. And she says that in verses 15 through 17. It's the last place we'll look today. Here's what it says. Catch the foxes for us, the little foxes that spoil the vineyards. For our vineyards are in blossom. My beloved is mine, and I am his. He grazes among the lilies. Until the day breeze and the shadows flee, turn, my beloved, be like a gazelle or a young stag on cleft mountains. So evidently there is a misnomer in the animal kingdom. There's a documentary on foxes, and I'm not so bored to watch a documentary on foxes. There has to be better things to do in life, but I did read a summary. And the documentary goes this way. Have you heard the statement, sly as a fox? And I was like, yeah, I've heard that statement. And the documentary says, no, they're really actually quite very stupid. Okay, so the documentary is based. They set a trap for a fox. The fox walks up to the trap and gets stuck in the trap. Day two, they set a trap. Day three, they set a trap. Day seven, day 14, day 20, day 21, they set a trap. And after 21 days, they're like, forget it. They're just stupid. Foxes are stupid. That's the new saying. Take that home with you. Foxes aren't sly. Foxes are stupid. Okay, that's the misnomer. Solomon's wife has worked in a vineyard. We saw that a few weeks ago. She knows what makes a vineyard thrive, and she knows what kills it. And one of the things that would kill a vineyard in her time and in her geographic location were these small little foxes that were about 15 inches tall. They would burrow into the vineyards, they would dig into the roots, and they would kill the very thing that was supposed to give them life. And so she's saying, the stupid little foxes, please kill them. She's listing out relational issues that aren't huge, but if you add them up together, if you have 50 foxes, you have a pretty big deal. So what are some of the relational issues that we have? Now listen, leaving your socks on the bathroom floor or your wet towel on the hardwood floor, leaving that hairball in the shower and not taking the trash out and playing Jenga on top of the trash, the first one who drops trash has to take it out, those are really nerve-wracking things, right? And you're squeezing your spouse's hand right now in your silent language of apology because I know that you're doing that, but those aren't the issues, really. That's just laziness. Stop it. Like, just stop it. You're a nuclear engineer, and you can't remember to put the toilet seat down. That's just lazy. Don't do that anymore, right? Those aren't the issues. As we end, and I have 4 minutes, and I'll end on time. Just three quick, sweeping categories of foxes that might be in your marriage. The first is relational foxes, that there's some relational issues. And you haven't grown relationally, and so it's just started to eat away at your marriage. Right? We said this last week. Pursuit is an art. And if you're going to have a deep relationship, you're going to have to learn to chase each other and hunt each other and be like a master working on a masterpiece. Your spouse is a masterpiece that the Lord has entrusted to you, and you're supposed to be the master artisan who is helping develop that thing. Right? And if you haven't learned to ask questions and stop talking and actually listen actively, then you're not pursuing them. And so relationally, you're starting to crash, and it's just a simple lack of pursuit. Or it's a lack of common things that you do together, right? How did you get together originally? You would do anything to spend time together. You would drive 700 miles in one weekend to spend 2 hours together to drive 700 miles back, and it cost you $400, and it's the best $400 that you ever spent. That's what you used to do, but now you don't spend any time together at all. And so you are doing this. You're choosing to grow apart. Nobody ever just grows apart. That's a lie that we bought into. Oh, we just grew apart. No, no. Every day, for weeks and years, you chose to grow apart. It's a relational issue, and we should fix it. It's simple. Have like hobbies and jobs and life and patterns, okay? Or games. Relationally, we play games like an eighth grader. We're adults, and we're still stuck in eighth grade. She was sharp to me, so I'm going to be muted with her. I gave him a hint, and he didn't get it. No more hints, no more pursuit. And we just do this endlessly as we play games. And we should own them as games and as foolish and just silly and let them be. They're relational foxes, and they're pretty easy to get rid of if we can point to them and say, let's get rid of these foxes. If that's you, do that, okay? That's the relational issue. The next fox, the category of foxes, is things that devour your time. We live overcomplicated lives, and so many things devour our time. We look at our spouse and we haven't seen them in days and weeks, even though we sleep beside them, and we're shocked that in a few years we don't even know who they are. I read a study this week that the average couple with a kid or two spends 4 minutes every day having adult conversation with their spouse. 4 minutes, that's it. So we're going to have to learn in our marriages that we're going to spend the time together that we've committed with each other. If you're married and you don't yet have kids, you have to use this phase of your life to develop life rhythms that can help you sustain the next 50 years of your life. Go to bed at the same time, wake up at the same time if you can, eat together, cook together, have hobbies that you both like. You don't have to give up all your hobbies, but make sure you're spending time together. And if you can't figure something out, you have to really labor to do that. And if you're a parent with kids, I understand absolutely how demanding children are. I understand that they sap every ounce of your energy, but you're still one with your spouse, and you have to figure it out. Right? I can't tell you how many times that my wife and I have been in this place where we have been asked too many questions by kids, that they've touched us too many times in one day, and they just won't stop talking, and you think to yourself, if anybody asks me any question again, I'm going to kill somebody. Like, that's honest, right? And so you get to this place where you just have all of your focus on your kids, and you don't have anything left over for anybody else. And this is the fight with parents, and it's a massive fight. When you do that, you dishonor God, you're crushing your marriage, and you're lying to your kids. Right? If you spend 4 minutes a day talking to your spouse, in 20 years when your kids are gone, your marriage is gone too. Because everything that was holding you together just walked out the door. You've been cohabitating and you're just done. You're going to have to figure that out. You're one with your spouse. You pledged a covenant to be with that person. And you've lied to your kids. You've taught your kids that they're the center of the world, and they're not the center of the world. You're raising raging narcissists, and that seems like it's too strong of a statement, but it really is. Every action, every day of their parents teaches them that everything is about them, when what they really need is parents who see Jesus dying for us, realizing that we're to die to each other, and creating this environment of mutuality and of love. And every study, both Christian and secular, say the most well-adjusted kids are those who realize that everything's not about them, see parents dying to themselves, and become well-adjusted human beings, well-adjusted parents. This is a major issue, and I wanted to pound on it a little bit. If you're a parent with kids, and you're struggling to figure out this balance, let's talk. Let's walk through life together. You can email me, tyler@vintagenc.com. You can talk to any of our pastors. If we need to start some groups to talk with parents about how to raise kids and love their spouse, we would love that opportunity. And then finally, the last category of foxes is the category of failures. We all have failures in life. If you're pursuing somebody to marry them and you're close, if you're engaged, there needs to be one time in your life where you sit down with that person and you go through every relational and sexual failure that you've encountered. Tell them everything. Don't harp on details, don't make them sin, but tell them everything. And if that person can't find forgiveness, it might take a week or 2 weeks, it might take a month even, but if that person can't forgive you, run for your life. Because if they can't forgive you now, it means they don't have any clue of their own brokenness, and it's going to be all that much worse when you get married to that person. If you're married and you can't forgive somebody for their past, you need help. And we would love to walk with you if we can. And then when you're married, if they're current failures, whether it's a failure of expectation, a failure of communication, a failure of provision, a failure of thought life, a failure of morality, these can be really large things. And there's no one sermon that can help you in that. It's why we've been dumped into this eternal family. And it's why as community group leaders and deacons and pastors and staff people, well, we can train and help you. And if it's beyond our ability, we have a large network of professional people that we would love to help you get connected with. So God's really good. He gave a woman a dream about abandonment, so you don't have to be in abandonment anymore. And he gives us very specific things, large things that we need to make sure are key in our marriage. And then he points very specifically to smaller things that are eroding the roots of our marriage. And he says, work on that. There's grace enough for you. And so leave hearing that well. There's grace enough for you. Go to God and be healed by him. Let's pray. God, we ask that in this moment you would work in ways that only you can work. How you love us, Jesus. For our friends who are here, who are doubters and seekers, who are very skeptical, who are atheists even, God, we love them. They belong here. They've walked into the presence of a real God who is great and powerful and has done all things to pre-love them and to currently love them and to love them for eternity. God, I know they don't believe that, and that's okay. Help them know they belong here, and whatever it takes for us to walk with them, for however long it takes, we want them to see you. And God, as you stir up in the hearts of seekers that Jesus is real, and they've been on this journey, and they've come to a place where they really believe, God, help them find faith in Jesus tonight, that he died for them, that he resurrected for them, but more than anything, his life is perfect, always worshiping God. And when we become a follower of Christ, we get the life of Jesus. And God, for us as followers of Christ, do that eternal work that heals our abandonment, heal our relational issues, heal our sharp tongues and our hardened hearts. May the coldness and the bitterness be cast out and the warmth of the sun be brought in. God, may we look at our marriage, and no matter how desperate it is, no matter how broken it is, hear with loud clarity, Jesus can heal and resurrect anything, and that we are covered by that word anything, for Jesus can heal us all. We love you, Jesus, and it's in your name that we pray these things. Amen.